The Public Safety Committee will come to order. Members, we have several bills on the agenda. Can we get through these all today, this morning? Yep. Okay, we have four bills on the agenda this morning, and then we'll take up the omnibus public safety financial supplemental budget bill, which I don't think should take too long. We'll take that up at 4 o'clock. First, though, we need approval of the minutes for March 25th. Representative Uglum makes that motion. Maybe he doesn't. Representative Kiefer makes that motion. Yes. Is there any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? Aye. That motion prevails. Okay. The first bill on the agenda is my bill, Representative House File 263. And Mr. Kingrey, are you here? I'm just going to do it from here because I think it'll go quickly and have you basically walk us through it a little bit. But members, what this does is it takes it amends the lists of offenses defined as crimes of violence to include felony assault in the fifth degree, felony domestic assault, and domestic assault by strangulation as crimes of violence. Mr. Kingrey can explain how this gets used, and Mr. Diebel more in charging. And we're in order. We're also removing three offenses from the crimes of violence, and they are let's see those. Mr. Kingrey, why don't you explain it?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Kingrey, testifying on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association this morning. Chairman Paymar described the bill accurately. Quite frankly, a number of years ago, several of our prosecutors, in reviewing the definition of crimes of violence, were very surprised not to see these offenses in there, especially the felony-level domestic assault and fifth-degree assault. These are individuals that have committed multiple assaults on individuals over a period of time, and so they're very serious person crimes. And so this has been a priority for the association for several years. I know when the expungement work group was meeting during the interim, in reviewing the crimes of violence, there was some discussion about why are some of these offenses in there. There has never been any opposition to the bill, and there is a small cost associated with adding these provisions in there, but then it's reduced by removing the theft of a motor vehicle, theft involving property from a burning, abandoned, or vacant building, or from an area of destruction caused by civil disaster, and by removing third-degree burglary. By removing those, that more than pays for the any costs associated with the bill. And with that, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Diebel, can I just ask you why we wouldn't see that on the bill as deleted language? Or, I don't see it, but I... Or is there an amendment to the bill? Okay, so now it seems like we have an amendment that we need to put on the bill. Mr. Kingrey.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, an amendment was drafted. It's my understanding that it was posted in time to meet the deadline, and it deletes various words, so it's not real clear what's being taken out, but it's the offenses that I just mentioned that amendment does remove from the definition.
Why don't we, not lay it over, but lay it over until the amendment is, I think that would be cleaner if we did it that way. Maybe, Mr. Welch, do you want to address the fiscal note to it? You're somewhat at a disadvantage also because with the amendment, I mean, I guess we're making some assumptions that there's a wash here financially.
Mr. Chair, the bill in its original form just has a small impact on the Department of Corrections, assuming that more people would be sentenced to prison. And I believe Mr. Kingrey testified that the intention is to take out some of those crimes so that the effect is nullified, but I don't have a copy of the amendment.
Okay, so Mr. Kingrey, let's just temporarily lay it over. We'll take it up as soon as we have the amendment, and we'll go then to House File 2156, Representative Rosenthal. Are you ready?
Yep.
This bill will be going to civil law. Representative Rosenthal, you want to move your bill and then tell us what it does?
I would like to move House File 2156 and have it referred to the Committee on Civil Law.
Very good. Representative Cornish.
Why are we going to civil law with part of the bill?
I have no clue.
You should have a better reason than that.
Representative Cornish.
Huh?
Representative Lesh, why is it going to civil law?
Remember we talked about in the House floor?
Representative Cornish.
Well, we just had a talk about in the House floor the other day, getting along and advising each other. So it's kind of disappointing we can't get at least a reason why it's going.
I guess as far as I know, members trying to be fair about this is I think it's always been the if a chair of a committee wants to see a bill, they have the right to do that. This committee could move this bill to the floor, and then Representative Lesh would have the, that's the way I'm understanding the rules, would have the ability to make a motion to have it re-referred to his committee. Whether it had language that relates to civil law or not, and the body would then make a decision on whether that was an appropriate motion. I don't know that we want to go that direction. I would hope that. So I don't know what to say. That seems. As long as I've been here, chairs have that kind of authority.
Mr. Chair,
if there was an answer, I would like to amend the motion, ask for a roll call vote to send it to the floor, I guess, if that's what you're okay.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Lesh.
Maybe I can ask Representative Cornish if after, have you read the bill, Representative Cornish?
Well, I'm familiar with from previous years and all our discussions about it. I was trying to figure out, not being on civil law, trying to find out what portion of the bill would send it to civil law. I know you don't like the idea from past conversations in history, but other than that, I was just looking for a specific reason other than not liking the bill.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesh.
You assume a lot, Representative Cornish. If you read the bill, you would see it clearly sets up an outside body to establish a set of administrative procedures for a state government agency, administrative procedures which are impacted by civil laws of the state of Minnesota. So there's absolutely no question that civil law committee has jurisdiction over it. If you are seeking to make a motion because you think I don't like the bill, that's your own prerogative. But let the record be clear that the jurisdiction of the civil law committee, this bill is well within it.
Maybe we could hear from the author and explain the bill, and maybe that will enlighten us a little bit about it, and then we can decide procedurally how we want to handle it. Is that okay? Representative Cornish?
That's fine with me.
Okay. Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 2156 attempts to make standards for crime labs, and this sort of came out of the St. Paul Crime Lab having so many problems with evidence. And this bill tries to set standards and goes through a way of ways of becoming accredited. As of now, I believe there's only 4 accredited labs in the state, 2 at the BCA, 1 at the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office, and 1 in Hennepin County, I believe.
Isn't there one in Anoka?
They're actually in.
They're in the process, I've been told.
In Anoka? Okay.
There is one thing I would like to point out to members, and that's just the legislative intent, which is starts on line 3.11, and states the legislator's intent in enacting this act is to improve quality of forensic analysis conducted in forensic laboratories within the state, and to impose minimum standards and provide greater uniformity for forensic analysis. It is not the legislature's intent to attempt to dictate a court's decision regarding the admissibility of forensic evidence or testimony, or the weight that evidence or testimony is given. And with that, I would like to turn it over to my testifiers.
Very good. Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record, and welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Catherine Knudsen, and I am the Director of the Forensic Science Services for the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. I am here testifying today in support of House File Bill 2156 on laboratory accreditation. The BCA's dedication to forensic laboratory accreditation is evident in the fact that we'll be celebrating our 20th year of accreditation this June. We've appreciated the opportunity to share our expertise on this subject with Representative Rosenthal as well as other parties during the drafting of this bill. So I'd like to start off with a very brief description of what accreditation is, and I believe there will be another testifier following me who can go into more detail, but simply put, accreditation is the recognition of, and in this case, a laboratory, meeting or exceeding a set of standards. So with that, I believe I'll go ahead and just walk through the bill.
Please, that would be helpful.
And explain each of the sections briefly. Section 1, Subdivision 1, of the bill covers definitions of forensic analysis and forensic laboratory. And what this does is this ensures that these requirements outlined in the bill are applied as intended. Exceptions to each of these definitions are also included to avoid the confusion and inappropriate application. For example, forensic analysis goes through 3 very specific criteria, what falls underneath forensic analysis, but then goes to make a list of exceptions so that these requirements are not overreaching and they're not applying to activities that are being performed in law enforcement agencies across the state that are inappropriate. For example, such as the evidence documentation, collection, screening, processing, the basic every day-to-day activities that are being done across the state that really don't truly need to be fall underneath the accreditation standards at this point. The forensic laboratory definition goes through what constitutes a laboratory and then also which types of entities or agencies do not fall underneath what is being considered a forensic laboratory. The goal is to really only target laboratories whose main function is to do forensic analysis on evidence for specific purposes. These entities that are excluded, such as medical examiner's offices, for example, they have their own level of oversight that's specific to their primary of expertise, so that's the limits to that definition. On page 2, we get into the appropriate application of specific accreditation standards to each of the common forensic disciplines. There's an A, B, and a C where it's outlined in A. It covers what would be required for a laboratory if they want to conduct forensic DNA analysis. Now, this is separated out from the rest of the disciplines because there are very specific criteria, mainly because of the use of the combined DNA index system, the CODIS system. So those requirements are outlined in that section. B covers other areas of forensic analysis, toxicology, identification of controlled substances, and trace evidence. And these particular disciplines have a heavy reliance upon instrumentation in addition to the technical and professional expertise of the practitioners. So the international standard that would apply to these disciplines is focused more upon making sure that those types of activities are covered. instrumental analysis. So the ISO 17025 is the stated required standard for those types of disciplines. Now the C covers kind of the remainder of forensic analysis disciplines, and these are more the comparative sciences. These are the types of disciplines that are really truly opinion-based, not relying upon instrumentation or instrumental analysis, but based on professional expertise of practitioners. And there are two international standards that are appropriate to cover these types of disciplines, and that is the ISO 17025 and 17020, and that is outlined in that section. This subdivision also provides the deadlines for a laboratory to either achieve accreditation or to have become or begun the process, and then ultimately provides a date where a lab must be accredited in order to operate within the state. Let's see here. And then later on, however, it's following our exceptions that allow some leniency. Accreditation, we understand, is a process. Many unforeseen situations can arise that preclude successful achievement within certain time frames. So the rest of the subdivision is dedicated to addressing the various specific situations that could occur and then the requisite extensions that would apply. And then finally, on the final page, the posting requirements. And the intent is that the information regarding accreditation status of laboratories operating within the state who are going to be creating, essentially doing testing that could be given and offered in a court of law, makes it available to the public what this accreditation status is. And at that point, I will be glad to entertain any
Chair.
Questions.
Representative Rosenthal, maybe you have the A1 amendment, which we haven't done yet.
Yes, I would like to move the A1 amendment.
Okay, Representative Rosenthal moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. What did the A1 amendment do?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This amendment allowed the City of St. Paul to be on board with the bill.
And can you say more than that?
I will leave that up to my testifier.
Did you want to testify about this, Ms. Knudsen, or the St. Paul issue?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I can state that this amendment, what this does is it clearly addresses when an existing accrediting laboratory, if they were to want to go on board with a new discipline, it explains the process by which one would want to do that.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Rosenthal,
this bill was the result of a lot of meetings over the interim with Representative Latz and lots of parties involved, and this was the language that they came up with to be comfortable with the bill.
So just so I'm clear, as a member from that city, so the City of St. Paul is okay with this bill as amended?
Mr. Chair, that's what I've been told.
Okay. And Mr. Dolish, did you want to testify? Welcome back to the committee. It's been a long time.
Yes. Chairman Paymar, my name is Frank Dolish. I'm the retired director of the BCA. Been before this committee a number of times, and I understand that you may be retiring from the legislature as well. I'll tell you that it's a good thing to be retired.
I have heard.
Chair, members, I wanted to just cover a little bit about forensic lab accreditation and tell you a little bit about what it is and what it isn't. Laboratory accreditation is a program that by which laboratories like the BCA, St. Paul, and others go to an accrediting body. That accrediting body would come out and inspect the lab to see that they have a number of operational criteria in place, including a quality management system, a quality assurance policies and procedures, as well as written and accepted by the general forensic community procedures for doing analytical procedures in the lab. Kathy Knutson mentioned that there are two standards, ISO standards, international standards, that are now being applied to forensic laboratories. That's 17025, which is for really for testing laboratories, and 17020, which in the ISO community is really for bodies that perform inspections. In addition to the ISO requirements, and there are a number of requirements under the ISO guidelines, they're both programs, if you're getting accredited in forensics, there are additional forensic criteria that laboratories must meet as well. And I think the language covers some of that after in the language after talking about 17025 and 17020. I do want to point out that, because there is some confusion, this is not certification. This is not, certification is for individuals. So, for example, in forensics, there are certification programs to be certified in DNA, to be certified in toxicology. That certifies the individual. What this bill is talking about is accreditation, and that is for the laboratory or the organization itself, not the individuals. It and there was some discussion in earlier hearings about accreditation won't necessarily mean that mistakes can't be made, and I would agree with that. But the power of accreditation is that if errors are made, the laboratory will have a written and verified process to be able to go through the area to determine what the root cause was, and then to put policies and practices in place to make sure, as well as humanly possible, that those errors don't happen in the future. I was on the board of one of the two organizations that credits crime laboratories around the country. That is called ASCLAB Lab. That stands for the American Society of Crime Lab Directors Laboratory Accreditation Board. I was on that board between 2003 and 2009. And was the chair of that board in 2008, and as now a private citizen and resident of St. Paul, I do think that this is extremely important legislation for this body to address and pass.
Thank you, Mr. Dolish. Are there any questions of the testifiers? Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Dolish. So, If a lab, crime lab, or any lab for that matter, forensic laboratory, is not accredited by this outside body, then it could not operate after July 1st, 2015. Is that correct?
Mr. Dolish.
Representative Lesh, I believe that the language provides that if they're in the process of getting accredited, that they would still be able to operate. It also, the amendment also adds some language so that, for example, in St. Paul, they're interested eventually in reopening their drug testing lab, and it provides language for them to be able to do that as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dolish.
Representative Lesh.
So what's the drop-dead date past which a lab cannot operate, a forensic lab cannot operate in Minnesota under this bill as amended?
Mr. Dolish.
I mean, Mr. Chair, I'm assuming, you know, that there's some language allowing people to kind of get ready and be in the process of, but I'm wondering we don't give them forever, right? So I'm wondering what the drop dead date is.
Mr. Dolish.
Chair Paymar, Representative Lesh, I believe that it's 3 years after that date.
Okay.
Representative Lesh.
Mr. Chair, I've been trying to figure out over the past couple year and a half that's been in the process, is there any other situation where we made a law up here affecting a government agency like a lab, but we outsource the standards by which it operates to a private entity, as opposed to, say, normally what we would do, we would say you can operate under the umbrella of a certain state agency or department, which would then go through the rulemaking process to establish the standards. But in this case, we are outsourcing that rulemaking to a private company. And maybe you haven't, because your area is specifically forensic labs, but in developing these protocols and writing the bill, were you able to determine, have we ever done that in Minnesota ever for any other government agency?
Mr. Dolish, I don't know if you have the answer to
that. Representative Paymar, Chair Paymar, Representative Lesh, I don't know.
Mr. Chair, maybe I could ask.
Is this list, okay, so there is... you should have in your packet, this is the correct, examples of Minnesota laws requiring accreditation or certification by private non-governmental bodies, and you'll see a list of about 10 of them. Can you give this to Representative Lesh? I have a copy.
And if you could, Mr. Chair and Ms. Knudsen, Mr. Chair, who prepared this list?
I really don't know, but as it says, debt management services, real estate appraisers, acupuncture practitioners, environmental labs,
but
a number of them. I didn't prepare it. It's a partial list. It came somewhere. Things just sort of come here.
So I've been asking for a list kind of like this for a while now, and so it's nice to finally have it. But so I'd like a little bit more time to review this. I guess between here and civil law, I could review it and see it, because it's relevant if, in fact, it prohibits them from operating at all. Last question, Mr. Chair, if I could. Mr. Dolish, how many procedures that you have performed as part of the crime labs you were involved with related to proceedings under civil law, provisions of state civil law?
Mr. Dolish?
Chair Paymar, Representative Lesh, I guess that forensic labs, for example, do DWI testing and some DWI hearings, I think, are civil.
Knudsen, do you want to add to that or no?
Mr. Chair, members, I believe that would be pretty much the limitations of what we would do that would be on the civil law level. I'm not quite sure, but our main duty is to provide testing for criminal investigations, so that is typically where.
So Mr. Chair, so and I understand maybe it's not your area, but implied consent proceedings would be testable by your lab, is that correct? Okay.
Ms. Knudsen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, yes, that's my name.
Thank you. Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish, I'm assuming that might satisfy your questions about whether or not this bill has anything to do with civil law. But other than that, I'd like the opportunity to review this list between here and civil law. But thank you for answering the questions.
We have two members, Representative Uglem and Johnson, next on the agenda.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to commend Representative Rosenthal for writing such a great bill. I've had the opportunity in my professional life to run numerous labs in manufacturing, and looking at what you've got here with the ISO standards and the quality assurance standards that you've got written into this bill, I think this is really very professionally done, and I really do mean that. It's so very important that, and I'm preaching to the choir here a little bit, but that the highest scientific standards be upheld in any lab like this. And by looking at all the accreditations that they call out here, all the ISO standards, if you've ever had the opportunity to look at the ISO book and you want to find out what ISO 17025 is, the book's about this thick. And it calls out every smallest, littlest detail in terms of what you're testing and how to test. We used to operate under ASTM, a lot of ASTM stuff, same thing. And so when you do something like this that is presented before us today, this is very good. It's gonna be removed beyond a shadow of a doubt any of the testing that goes on as far as the lab goes. I just have one question about the individual accreditations. How is that going to work now with these new standards that come in, and what kind of procedures are the individuals going to be going through in the lab?
Ms. Knutson or Mr. Dolish?
Mr. Chair, Representative Uglum, there is no mandatory requirement for individual accreditation, because essentially accreditation is for the, Mr. Dolish explained earlier, is for the agency itself.
Mm-hmm.
Individual certifications would be something that would cover that. And essentially, this is not requiring certification of the individuals, mainly because the disciplines are so specific, and there's not necessarily certification available for each of these specific disciplines. However, through the process of the accreditation assessments, a major part of the assessments, as you probably know through your familiarity with the ISO, is the expertise, the training,
right,
and the experience of the individuals who are doing the work. They are required to go through proficiency testing on a regular basis, continuing education. So, in essence, an accreditation of the laboratory with the surveillance visits and the entire process, look at that information, vet that information as well.
Okay.
Representative Uglum.
One further question. With regard to Representative Lesh's question, examples of laws requiring accreditation from non-governmental bodies, could you expand a little bit on the environmental labs, the accreditation through NELAP and things? I mean, that is maybe a little similar in terms of what's going on in terms of national standards and things that you're calling out here, and I imagine the environmental labs are very similar.
Ms. Knutson, do you have an answer for that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I really don't have an answer for that. That's outside the scope of my expertise at this point, the requirement and accreditations for laboratories that don't fall underneath the forensic umbrella.
Mr. Chair, I guess my point is that there's all these national groups. If you're a paint manufacturer, if you're a Dow Chemical, if you're a crime lab or whatever, there's all these national groups. There's all these standards that you have to, if you're running a credible operation, all these standards that you have to comply with. And so I just think this is right on, spot on, and I think it's going to take care of our problems. So I applaud you. I really do. I think it's a good, good bill.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Knutson, I'm just wondering what's the potential outcome could be if evidence is considered tainted because it wasn't in the because the lab wasn't in the process of accredit according to the accreditation standards.
Ms. Knutson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, at this point in time, that's the current state of the situation here in the state of Minnesota. And truly what happens is that the reliability of that evidence and the question regarding whether it's applicable to the proceedings or the crime that it's being associated to is truly up to the judicial system. So once it hits the court of law, that's truly where that is vetted at this point in time. And that will be what would happen in the future. I don't believe that's going to change, even with mandatory accreditation.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Knutson. So in other words, if without getting this accreditation and making sure the labs are following the proper procedures, law enforcement and the BCA lab and the other labs has the possibility all their evidence getting thrown out in court?
Ms. Knutson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, with or without accreditation, that is always a possibility. With accreditation, what that does, and I think Mr. Dolish touched on this, is that it puts a process in place to both prevent that from happening as much as possible and to identify when there are issues within a laboratory to prevent it from happening in the future. There's a very, it's very much focused around corrective actions, a lot of these ISO standards. So when something happens, it has a better possibility of being caught on the front end, addressed, and have the proper root cause and the remediation steps applied to it so that it doesn't happen again.
Representative Johnson.
So in other words, this bill is putting in safeguards to protect the integrity of the evidence.
Ms. Knutson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes.
Thank you. One more comment as far as what Representative Lesch had stated. I've been involved in numerous implied consent hearings as an officer. What the implied consent hearing is discussing the probable cause for the stop and whether there's probable cause to obtain the sample for to send the testing down. It doesn't do anything with the testing itself. It's just if there's probable cause to have that test performed.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Simon, would you like to introduce your guests?
I would. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I just want to say you probably saw a bunch of people filing in. They are ninth graders from St. Louis Park High School. They're here participating in the Capitol Historic Sites Voice of the People, Your Role in Minnesota Government. It's a tour and educational program, so please join me in welcoming them.
Okay, other questions before we Representative Rosenthal, do you have some comments that you would like to make after hearing we have a motion actually that's been made by, well, you've made a motion. What is your motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My motion was originally to send refer House File 2156 to the General Register, but Representative Lesch had mentioned to me that he wanted to see it in civil law, and rather than go through the procedure of getting it to the House floor and recalling it, I then made the motion to have it heard in civil law.
Okay, so that's the motion. And now I just need to procedurally need to know, do we need to act on that motion before we act on Representative Cornish's motion if he's going to make it?
I guess I just ask for a roll call vote on this motion. Go ahead with the civil law motion.
Okay, so Representative Cornish has asked for a roll call.
Could I explain that?
Please, Representative Cornish.
Representative Rosenthal, you're a nice guy. You've never been known to be arrogant or pompous, or you always answer my questions, so I would like to ask you, what is your real intention? I fear for your bill if it goes there, and I'd rather then see it die and give it a chance for life and make somebody work for it if they're going to kill it. So do you have any confidence that it will come out of civil law?
Representative Rosenthal.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, thank you, first of all. And I have been assured by the chair that it will come out of civil law. However, it is my preference for it to go to the floor.
Then I will keep my roll call for now.
Okay.
Yeah, we do.
Members, I would ask that you, Representative Rosenthal.
It's getting late in the deadline process. And so at this point, I know the Representative Lesh will recall it from the General Register. So in order to speed the process along, I would make my motion that it go to Committee on Civil Law.
I'll just withdraw my withdrawal.
Okay.
I don't want to put him through the pain.
Representative Cornish has withdrawn his ask for a roll call. So therefore, any further discussions on the motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. Yep. We'll go back to House File 263. You should have an amendment. It is the A1 amendment. Mr. Kingray, you want to come back down? So we now have the amendment, and I believe that the deleted crimes from the crimes on violence, if you look at the bottom on 1.22, this is the theft involving the intentional taking or driving of a motor vehicle without consent of the owner or authorized agent of the owner, theft involving the taking of property from burning, abandoned, or vacant buildings, or from an area of destruction caused by civil disaster, riot, bombing, or the proximity of battle. Who writes these? Did we ever charge anyone for that? Okay, and then the other one, and then on lines 2.4, what are we taking out there? That's third degree burglary, is Mr. Kingray, is that?
Mr. Chairman, that members of the committee, that's correct.
And then the other burglary, okay, just third degree burglary. And Mr. Waltz is saying that his conversation with the DOC, with the Department of Corrections, that there is no cost to this bill if we do this. And anything else you want to say, Mr. Kingray? Therefore, Chair will move the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. Is there any, I didn't ask that last bill either. Is there anyone that was just to speak in favor or in opposition to House File 263? Is there any further discussion on the bill? Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, earlier when we were discussing this, they talked about on line 1.3, assault in the fifth degree as just being the felony portion of that statute. The way this current bill is written, if I would happen to go up to you and pinch you in the arm, by the definition of bodily harm in the misdemeanor statute for fifth degree domestic assault, that would fall under a crime of violence with just 609.224 listed. If it was just the felony portion, it should be 609.224 sub 4.
I'm trying to follow you here, Representative Johnson. So you're saying that the statute reference is wrong? Ms. Furious?
Mr. Chair and members, if you look on line 1.7, it's prefaced with felony convictions of the following offenses. So it would just be the felony convictions under 609.224.
Thank you, Ms. Perius. You saved Mr. Kingray and the chair from trying to figure it out. Okay. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Any further discussion? All those in favor of House File 263... I'm sorry, this will be referred to the... I'll renew my motion that House File 263 gets placed on the General Register. All those in favor, as amended. It's a good thing there's people here. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails. Now, it's a good thing we're getting to deadlines, too. We have the Department of Corrections here to... and the Department of Public Safety. We'll take the Department of Corrections first to discuss the supplemental budget that we will be taking up this afternoon and the funding request. Deputy Commissioner Carlson, do you want to start, or we do have some slides that you can follow along with.
Mr. Chair, actually, I'm going to have Assistant Commissioner Wojcik start the presentation.
Okay. Commissioner Wojcik, welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. We have a very short presentation here today on the governor's recommendations for a budget for the Department of Corrections. We actually only have two operating increases for the department. The first one, if you look on slide three, is for our employee compensation to retain already existing staff. This is not for new staff. It's a $19 million increase. Public safety is a core responsibility of government, and our current law appropriations did not provide funding for any increases bargained with the unions for fiscal years 14 and 15. This funding level assumes a 3.5% vacancy rate. It will avoid layoffs, and that amount equates to about 262 positions for us. If you look on slide four, we separate out the costs by expense category. $13.5 million is for across the board and step increases. $3.2 million is for employer-paid health insurance. $1.3 is for retirement contributions, and there's $1 million for FICA and other fringe benefits. We've also separated this out by the multiple bargaining units that work in the Department of Corrections. On slide five, we just want to talk a little bit about agency budget considerations that DOC has that are fairly unique. We are, of course, 24/7 operations. We have 10 facilities, incarcerate over 9,500 offenders, and provide supervision in the community for approximately 122,000 offenders. We don't have any ability to control our admissions, and we have very limited ability for early releases. 95% of our costs are general fund dollars. We do not have any substantial way to increase revenue or bring money into the department. We have very limited federal funds. About 70% of our employees work in positions that are significant offender contact. This makes them eligible for corrections retirement. There's about 2,900 employees who have this, and our contribution to that pension plan is 12.1% compared to 5% for staff not in that pension plan, which is a significant cost for the department. And then we also pay health insurance costs from the time these staff retire after age 55. With that, I will turn it over to Deputy Commissioner Carlson to talk about our population growth.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Terry Carlson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Facilities
Welcome
Division.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm just going to talk briefly about the population growth that we have unexpectedly experienced. Earlier this session, Dr. Grant Dewey presented information about our population projection increase. And what we have seen is an approximate 8% increase in new court commits over the past year, and that's the largest increase in the last 5 years. So this request is for $11.1 million. It's a one-time adjustment for fiscal 2015. It equates to 513 beds at our marginal per diem rate for a year. Slide seven just gives more detail about the increase in court that we've seen, that really the information the increases aren't confined to one specific type of offense, nor one particular part of the state. And with that, we will stand for questions.
Questions of Deputy Commissioner Carlson or Assistant Commissioner Wojcik? I just want to say we've already had a hearing on the projection problem. I still don't quite understand how we have an unforeseen 8% increase in new court commits, but obviously we do, and we have to pay to rent those beds from our county jails. But that's the largest increase in 5 years, you've stated. And so next year, I would imagine the department will be coming forward with some bonding request to build, to add on to a prison in order to accommodate. Or is it premature to even talk about that? But if the trend continues, you can't keep renting bed space, can you, or can you?
Mr. Chair, thanks for the question. We are doing some studies right now in our facilities to explore the feasibility and cost of increasing beds at several different sites. I think it's very, very likely that we will be coming for bonding money in 2 years. We believe that we can continue to rent enough beds from county jails to get us through. And we're looking at also trying to increase early release opportunities through our challenge incarceration program. We have expanded treatment, which we know has good outcomes for recidivism reduction. And there's one more thought that I had in my head, but it slipped away. But yes, we'll be back.
Okay. I just, you know, for whatever, perhaps some more.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And along that same line, Commissioner, I remember that hearing, and there were lots and lots of questions about the validity of the study. So are you still very comfortable with the projections here and the validity of the study and the reliability of the study? And you mentioned that you're doing some other studies. So are other studies looking at validating that study? Or... because I remember, Mr. Chair, a lot of us had questions about, and it didn't appear very clear, the answers that we were getting. So that's a question I'd like to ask.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, I'd like to respond to that.
Assistant Commissioner Wolchek.
That study had been validated. The studies Deputy Commissioner Carlson is talking about is for where we can expand. So there are more building studies. What we do need to do as a department, however, is try to figure out how we can get better court data so we're not surprised by an increase like this, that we can gather data from the courts better to incorporate that into our projections.
Representative Ward. Well, for what it's worth, we'll see what happens. But I did put in a request to the legislative auditor to look at, I'm hoping that they'll take that up as a project and at some point and look at how you're saying that study was validated, but I'm not convinced. I don't want to doubt Dr. Dewey and his work, but he made a good presentation, but it just boggles the mind that it could be so off. So I'm hoping the legislative auditor will take that on as a project in the future, because the legislature can't be planning for the future having such disparity. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, since we had that initial hearing, I've done some little bit of reading, and I ran across an article where it's just not Minnesota that's ran into this issue with being off on their bed space projections. Many states are having that issue, and one question that may have come up is, when they did the study, if they didn't factor in the economy into that with the downturn of the economy, and now the bed space is catching up with that issue.
Right. Well, and I do think that the issue about the silos that the DOC could do a better job or improve matters by having better communication with the courts, so you would know if there's trends going on in terms of offenders being committed to the department. So maybe it will resolve itself. I don't know. But it's disturbing that, we're at this place. Any other questions? Thank you. We'll be taking up the supplemental budget request this afternoon. Unless
you
have
your time today.
Closing comments. Okay.
Thank you.
And we're going to try to do the Department of Public Safety now, too, as long as we have time. Do we have? Welcome to the committee. Could you just, I know we're bringing you up prematurely, but if you want to do it now, or you can come back this afternoon if you're not ready.
No, I'm fine.
Okay. So if you would just, the two of you would introduce yourself to the record and proceed and tell us what's in this, why and what's in the supplemental budget.
Thank you, Representative Paymar, members of the committee. My name is Jackie Mines. I am the director of the Emergency Communication Networks Division of the Department of Public Safety. ECN is responsible for the collection of the 911 fee and the management of three programs funded through that fee: 911, ARMOR, which is a statewide radio system, and FirstNet, which is the wireless broadband dedicated to public safety.
Mr. Chair, my name is Larry Freund. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Public Safety.
Welcome.
The requests today are to move 911 monies from the unallocated allotment to the ECN operating budget. The first is extending the balance of a 2009 appropriation to complete the next generation 911 project. Because of delays in the federal acceptance of industry standards, this project, and the fact that it was a three-phase project, we are finally getting this project completed, and the balance of this will be billed in this upcoming 2 years. The second request is recommending $5.059 million in 2014 and $6.865 million in 2015 from the 911 fund to maintain both the old and the new networks until the new network is stable. Funds will also be used to perform an audit on all the 911 network elements so that we can get rid of the legacy network that's not going to be used anymore, and to transfer the central telephone office trunks to that new backbone.
Ms. Mines, or maybe Mr. Waltz, I don't know if you can answer. So this is a special revenue account, and this comes from what again? This is from a fee on everyone's phone service, right?
That is correct. 911 fee is collected on every wireless phone, wireline phone, VoIP phone.
And how much money is in the special revenue account right now?
Mr. Chair, the current balance of the 911 fund right now is approximately, it's kind of a difficult, what we have is a balance that's not been allotted or legislatively appropriated to us, and then we get revenues every daily on the actual receipts in there. So right now our balance is probably around $20 million. And that takes into account this money that we're requesting right now that's already been collected. And then what do we get on a regular basis through the receipts to operate the 911 program?
So I just want to make sure I understand this. So you have the $20 million includes the roughly $12 million supplemental request.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And so why wouldn't you spend the $10 million now before requesting more money from the legislature? I just don't understand the accounting here.
Mr. Chair, what happens here, what we did in the last biennial budget process, we only put the number in of the estimated receipts that we would get over the next 2 years. What we should have done was to put in what we needed to spend to operate these systems here. So the money had already been collected, but we can't spend the money unless the legislature actually appropriates the money to us. So the money sits in the account until it's appropriated. So we're just asking for money that's in that account right now to operate this. And we should have done this in the biennial budget process.
So then will you then spend this $20 million in the next in what time frame?
Mr. Chair, the $20 million, there's a part of the fund that has to stay in there for cash flow purposes, but we spend the money on it's on an ongoing basis to operate the 911 program. And right now there's just a balance in there that we're asking some of that money to be used specifically to operate this year and next year, additional money than we asked for originally during the biennial budget process.
Any questions? Okay, we'll take this up this afternoon too. Thank you for your presentation.
Thank you.
Anything else? Okay, so we are in recess until 4 o'clock in room 500 South. The Public Safety Committee is reconvening. We're going to go through this very quickly. I know, I apologize, we had a very long Judiciary Committee meeting. That and so we're going to do the supplemental budget. So the chair will move the DE-1-3 amendment. First, I will move House File 3273 that will be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. And now I would like to move the DE-1-3 amendment. And then I have an amendment to that. So I think we need to vote on that amendment first. Is there any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. Now I will move the A2 amendment, and I will explain everything that we're doing here, but this is getting the bill in the shape that I would like it after. So I'll move the A2 amendment. Is there any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye. 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 Opposed? That motion prevails. Now, I think what I would like to do, we can walk through the bill a little bit, but there's been some changes. So I think what I'd like is, Mr. Waltz, if you could walk through the spreadsheet, and then I'll talk about some of the specifics in the bill. So let's go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, the spreadsheet reflects the last amendment to the amendment that was, I believe, was just adopted, and it makes some changes from some funding that the chair had communicated to you in the past, the extent of which I'll just explain briefly. Representative Moline's bill on expungements, 2576, has been decided by leadership that that will move on its own. The committee is no longer required to pay for that in its target, and some of those dollars were put back into places that had been previously reduced. Also, Representative Winkler's bill, I believe that was House File 1126, was amended. That was criminal sexual conduct by an authority figure. He amended the bill so that there was no fiscal note. That bill was also then removed to move on its own, and the dollars then were again reallocated. And also, there was an amendment to 2142 Yaruso's bill. The fiscal note previously was $70,000. That increased, so that was the funding for that was increased slightly. So, members, starting at the top of the spreadsheet, the Department of Corrections, an operating increase for critical staff. This was to meet the salary needs of their contract. They requested $19 million, or $19 million was provided in the governor's budget. We have included $18,950,000, so a reduction of $50,000 from the agency's original request. We've included the request in its entirety that was in the governor's budget for prison population growth, the county rental beds. This was due to the need arose from an inaccurate assessment of the beds that they would need for this biennium. Mr. Chair, moving down, House File 1851, Representative Kiefer's bill for fifth-degree criminal sexual conduct for repeat offenders is included. There's no cost in this biennium, but a short or a small amount of fiscal impact on the department is included in the tails. Mr. Chair, moving down, as I previously mentioned, House File 2142, Yaruso's bill for victim notification is included at the new figure of $125,000 in fiscal 2015. Moving down to the Department of Public Safety, we've included the governor's and agency's request for emergency communications network funding that the agency detailed previously today. Below that is House File 2701. It's Representative Pawlowski's bill for disaster FEMA match funding, a statutory appropriation that would be available to the department. Representative Pawlowski's bill requested $6 million. We have funded it at $5,661,000. Mr. Chair, moving down the culturally specific domestic abuse grants, we have $300,000 in for that purpose. We have $50,000 in for House File 2478 O'Driscoll's request for veteran de-escalation training grants. House File 3273, Representative Paymar's bill for sexual assault prevention grants is included for $300,000. And House File 2972, Representative Savick's bill to allow the Board on Firefighter Training to spend the unencumbered and unexpended balance in that fund of $1.3 million. And, Mr. Chair, under the Post Board, we are carrying a figure that would reflect extending a exploited youth grant that was made in the previous session. They did not feel that they would be able to spend that in time, so that number represents extending that grant an additional year. Mr. Chair, that...
Okay, thank you, Mr. Waltz. And so just to reiterate, if you want to look at the DE-13 bill, you'll see the language, and I just want to just say a couple of things about the recommendations here. The... $300,000 to OJP is specifically targeted to culturally specific programming for new immigrant populations. So this is the language that this came from Representative Clark. This fits. This is more consistent, I think, with how we have funded shelter programs and shelter programs that have specific cultural needs in the past. And so that is that language is found on page 2 of the bill. The sexual assault prevention grants would go also to OJP, and they would be competitive grants that would MnCASA, what would be, it would go to OJP, and then people would apply, communities would apply, organizations would apply, so.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay, Ms. Dunn, you better come up to the microphone, I'm sorry. Just want to make sure we're doing this right. Ms. Dunn?
Okay, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, our understanding is that this would be managed a similar way that the current funding for Champion Communities has, in that the grant is the funding is held by the Office of Justice Programs, and then we've worked with them. We've created the funding opportunities for local community groups out of MnCASA. But we haven't, that's the assumption that we're working on, is that it would be the same mechanism that we've used currently for the prevention grants.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Any questions of that? Mr. Ward?
Just to make sure that it's a statewide program.
Ms. Dunn?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Ward, absolutely it will be a statewide program. We have worked diligently to make sure that we're reaching out to the rural areas, not only the metro area.
Thank you, Ms. Dunn. And then just to the question about the O'Driscoll bill, this is actually going to the Post Board, and they will make the determination on training on de-escalation techniques for law enforcement. There's the Holberg bill that also reinstates the advisory council to the fire safety committee. That is on page 9 of the bill. Is there anything else I wanted to reserve? That's it. So, any questions? Bill. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to speak to the bill? Ms. Richards? Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. I'm Liz Richards. I'm at the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. The coalition has been was founded 35 years ago, and we're a membership organization. We have over 80 member programs providing a range of services throughout the state. Our programs include emergency shelters, transitional housing, parenting time centers, criminal justice systems, and community advocacy programs. And I know I testify in front of a lot of your committees a lot of the time, but I wanted to take just a little bit to give you a little bit more information so you understand the context in which I'm going to talk about the funding going to the culturally specific domestic violence program in the bill. We have 26 emergency shelters right now that are our member programs. We have 16 culturally specific programs, and of those programs, seven of them are culturally specific shelter programs. There is an absolute need for additional funding and resources. We know that over 62,000 women seek services from our programs every year. And we know from national research that only between 20 and 30% of women who experience domestic violence actually reach out for services. We also know the National Network to End Domestic Violence conducts a one-day census count each year. And September 17th of 2013 was the census count date. On that day, with only 60% of our programs participating, there were still 193 people who were seeking housing services and were turned away for lack of space. So we know that the needs are out there. We also know the needs are much more complex and the barriers are much greater to get services in culturally specific communities and in new immigrant communities. For those reasons, we support the additional funding and specifically funding for newer immigrant communities. But I also want to speak to why we believe that this is the right way to fashion the money. That over the 35 years we've been doing this work, we've done this work with our member programs, we've worked with the Office of Justice Programming around the funding, and we've learned a few things. And part of what we've learned is that we do not support funding directed appropriations to any one program. We don't want to be pitting our programs against each other in requests here at the legislature. We don't want to have individual programs lobbying you for their funding appropriations. We know that different programs have greater or lesser abilities to lobby here at the Capitol. And if we had individual programs lobbying, we would really truly have inequitable funding decisions being made. The other thing is the Minnesota Auditor's Office came out with a report a number of years ago and strongly suggested that the Office of Justice Programming move to a fully competitive funding process rather than having designated programs receiving funding. The Office of Justice Programming shifted to that competitive model 2 years ago, and we believe that's the right approach. We believe that the Office of Justice Programming is the correct entity to allocate the money. The Office of Justice Programming has put together a network of services to address the needs across crime victim areas, across geographic areas, cultural communities. They work to meet the emerging needs, both new communities coming into the state and new issues. Minnesota has long been a national leader with domestic violence work. We had the first shelter in the country here in Minnesota, the Duluth model, coordinated community response work, the blueprint for safety. Minnesota is also a national leader in understanding the need for culturally specific services. I absolutely believe in the need for targeted money for the newer immigrant communities work, and I support targeting this money to programs that work within the community. It's important to know that there are other programs who work in newer immigrant communities who do not currently receive state funding. I'll give you just one example is the CEWA program receives state funding. I'll give you just one example is the CEWA program. They work with the Indian and Pakistani immigrant communities and they receive no state dollars for their work. There are a few programs already working in the Somali community. They're not able to meet all of the demand and the needs. Having a new program willing to tackle the housing needs is great, but it's not the only need that exists within that immigrant community. The Office of Justice Programming and the Coalition provide support to new programs, helping them address the myriad of issues that come up with establishing new programming. We even assist programs with grant and the funding process, and we want new programs to succeed absolutely, and we want them to make sure that they meet the needs of battered women and their families in our communities. The last thing I want to address is that the money be allocated not just for emergency shelter, but for shelter, housing, and advocacy services. The coalition is currently in discussions with programs across the state, with the other anti-violence coalitions, and with funders, looking at how to understand diverse needs in the state and how to allocate resources in the best way possible. A lot of that discussion is focusing on shelter and housing dollars. We think it's best to build flexibility in around those dollars so that programs can have the greatest flexibility in meeting the needs that they identify in their communities. We also need to know that emergency shelter services are the most expensive and complex services that are provided in our field. We want to make sure that any program receiving this money has the flexibility necessary to make sure that they succeed. So I just wanted to provide that information to the committee, and that's why we fully support the approach being taken for the allocation of the $300 within House File 3273 as amended by the DE1 amendment.
$300,000.
$300,000, yes. Or we could go
ahead. Are there any questions of Ms. Richards? I know that Representative Clark had some different ideas about the funding, and I would just hope that your program would work with the coalition and OJP. I'm very supportive of your efforts, East African community in Minnesota, and there's definitely need for shelter services, so we'll keep working on this, okay? And I think that this provides some additional dollars in the right way. I was actually not speaking to you. I was speaking to someone in the audience, okay, is there any other questions for Ms. Richards? Any other discussions on the bill? Questions on the bill? Representative Cornish?
Only that I have no objections, and it's been nice working with you. And where does it go from here? Ways and Means?
It goes to Ways and Means. Representative Cornish, thank you very much for your support and your help. We seem to work together on these budget issues very well, and I appreciate your leadership and keeping your caucus included in our decision making. Anything else? Okay, then the chair will move. I'll renew my motion that House File 3273, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion? All those in favor of that amendment signify by saying aye. 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 Opposed. Aye. That motion prevails. We are adjourned. Thank you, and I apologize for us being.